Welcome to the first edition of the 2 Degrees Show, the UK's only weekly programme devoted to climate change. As the series unfolds over the next few weeks, we'll be looking at the scale of the challenge now ahead of us. We'll be following the UN climate negotiations as they unfold in Nairobi in November, and the worldwide demonstrations that will accompany them. We'll be speaking to George Monbiot, who has just written a book showing how the UK can turn itself into a virtually carbon-free society in a matter of decades. And we'll be meeting the low-carbon trendsetters that are showing us the way forward. As well as showing you how you can live a low-carbon lifestyle, we'll be giving you ideas for how to get involved in the campaign to get the kind of global deal that the scientists are telling us we now need. On today's show, we'll be putting the series on a firm foundation by getting a reminder of the scientific consensus on the basic science of climate change from one of the UK's leading authorities. Later in the programme, we'll be speaking to Dr. Alice Bowes from the Tyndall Centre, but we start by speaking to David Griggs, the director of the Hadley Centre, which is the Met Office's Centre for Climate Prediction and Research.
For people that are new to this area or still think that the basic science is in dispute, can you say what the view of the scientific community is on the link between the burning of fossil fuels and global warming?
Yes, certainly. I think you can split the question into two parts. The first is the world warming? And the second part, is it being caused by human beings? On the first part, I don't think there's any doubt whatsoever that the world has warmed. It's warmed by about 0.7 degrees Celsius over the last 100 years. Mountain glaciers have retreated, sea level has risen, lake and river ice is thawing earlier and melting and freezing later in the year. The Arctic sea ice thickness has decreased. There are a whole raft of measures which give a very clear indication that the world has warmed over the last 100 years. What that doesn't say is what's caused it. And it's a much harder question because the weather changes day to day, week to week, month to month, year to year. But when you actually look into it and you use the computer models which we use to predict future climate, and you look at all the different factors that could be causing this increase, then the conclusion, not just of ourselves, but of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the UN assessment body on climate change, is that most of the warming that we've observed over the last 50 years is due to human influence.
Under a business-as-usual scenario, that is, if emissions of greenhouse gases continue to rise at their present rate, what are the range of temperatures predicted by the latest IPCC report, which was the 2001 report?
The range of temperatures predicted is for a range of scenarios, so it depends on how much greenhouse gas we emit over the coming century. And the range of temperature increase we predict is 1.4 to 5.8 degrees Celsius, so in other words, quite a lot more than the temperature increase we've seen over the 20th century. And even the smallest of those, 1.4 degrees Celsius, would be unprecedented rate of temperature increase in at least the last 10,000 years, and probably a lot longer than that.
The range of temperatures is wide, as you say, but probably the business as usual scenario, the range of temperatures would be to more likely towards the centre of those that range.
Yes, I mean the bottom of that range is for a world which doesn't emit as much greenhouse gas. The population peaks in mid-century and starts to go down. We very rapidly switch to new clean energy technologies. Those clean energy technologies are transferred very rapidly to the developing world, so they're adopted by them as well. The upper range is where the world continues to develop rapidly, economically, but all of that economically development is fueled through fossil fuels.
Right.
And so, you know, other scenarios are somewhere in the middle.
Am I correct to say that the role of amplifying feedback effects was not fully taken into account in the 2001 report?
In the 2001 report, what we called carbon cycle feedbacks were not taken into account. What we mean by carbon cycle feedbacks are the feedbacks with the plants and the trees and things like that, where plants and trees absorb carbon dioxide and then emit oxygen back into the atmosphere. And the change in climate affects how well the trees and the plants do that. And then how well the plants and the trees do that then also affects climate change. And that sort of feedback loop was not included in the third assessment report.
Right, but...
And that would act to amplify any warming.
Okay. So has understanding about those feedbacks and how they work, and has that increased?
That has increased over the period since 2000, when the third assessment report appeared, yes.
Right. So is it too early to say whether that's included in the new... in the new report?
Those feedbacks will be included in the new report.
Okay.
Yes.
Giving a greater temperature rise, or...?
Obviously, I can't say what the results of the new report are. It's still under review at the moment.
Okay. There seems to be a consensus emerging around the idea that 2 degrees centigrade of warming in global average temperatures represents a threshold that we shouldn't cross if we want to avoid catastrophic global warming. Can you tell us about some of the studies that support that view?
Well, this is very much a sort of political target, first mooted by the European Union. And the sort of science which supports that is, you know, that clearly the more the temperature increases, the worse the impacts get. The less the temperature increases, the less bad the impacts are. So the 2 degree sort of temperature increase is not a sort of thing to do with the climate system, where it sort of all sorts of disasters suddenly start to happen in the climate system. It's very much a what type of damage and what type of impacts do you as a society want to choose to avoid.
But there are some major impacts that have been identified for the biosphere if we do cross the two degrees threshold. Obviously, you know, different studies vary.
That's right.
But could you tell us what is understood with some degree of confidence that might happen beyond 2 degrees C?
Not really. As I say, as the temperature increases, and as the rate of temperature increase gets bigger, then the risk of some of these things happening gets worse. You can't, as far as I'm aware, you can't say, you know, this will start happening at 2 degrees, because we don't know enough about the climate system to say, this is exactly going to happen at 2 and not at 2.5. What you can say is that, you know, the quicker you get and the higher it gets, the more risk you're putting. Risk of feedbacks such as rapid dieback of the Amazon, rapid release of methane from permafrost and from the deep ocean, rapid increase in melting from the Greenland ice sheet, possible instability of the West Antarctic ice sheet, possible breakdown of the Gulf Stream. All of those kinds of things, the quicker and the greater the magnitude, the more the risk of those things happening and becoming a sort of runaway effect are. But we don't know enough about the climate system to be able to say, well, that's going to exactly happen at 2 degrees and not at 2.1 or 1.9. For example, we don't even know what a 2 degrees C rise in temperature exactly means for what the concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere could be. Because what we call the climate sensitivity, how sensitive the climate is to a doubling of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, could be somewhere in the range of 1.5 to 4.5 degrees.
Right.
So if the climate sensitivity is right at the high end of what we think it might be, the temperature change is going to be increased by 4.5 degrees for a doubling of CO2, then if you're trying to limit it to 2, you can nowhere near double CO2.
Right.
If it's down at the bottom end, then you can slightly more than double CO2 and still stay within 2 degrees. So, there's a fairly wide level of uncertainty there.
Just a few questions about some of the recent studies that recent kind of headline news items that have come up.
Yeah.
In terms of the carbon cycle feedback that you talked about earlier, the kind of turning point in that cycle for when the positive, so-called positive feedback would kick in would be when the Amazon would turn from a net sink of carbon into a net source, when the Amazon dries back, and that was predicted to happen around 2050. But there was a drought, severe drought, I understand, last year in the Amazon, and I think there's not been a huge amount of rainfall this year To what extent is that putting stress on the Amazon, and is that happening a lot earlier than we might have thought?
Again, what we don't know is whether the observations of the severe sort of drought they had last year is just a one-off, or whether it's the start of a signal of climate change. Trees react well to carbon dioxide in that they grow quicker. And so they expect to absorb more CO2, so that's what they say, they're actually the sink of CO2 increases. However, as the temperature increases, the microbial activity in the soils and the way that the wood rots also becomes quicker, and eventually that sink becomes a source. There is still a lot of uncertainty about where that transition might be. And certainly the sort of one or two observations from last year certainly aren't enough to indicate a trend that's happening.
Are there any other major bits of research that might have come through in the last 12 months that you might think are significant?
Do you know the one about the summer 2003?
It's worth mentioning again, I think. That's the summer heat wave.
That's right, yeah. The European summer heat wave that we had, it was really an extraordinarily warm summer in Europe in 2003. Tens of thousands of people died across Europe. The temperatures, we estimate that if we hadn't had any climate change, then that would be something like a 1-in-1,000-year summer. Hmm. Because of the greenhouse gases we've already put in the atmosphere in the past, we reckon that we've already more than doubled the risk of seeing a summer like that. Hmm. But to give you an indication, if we look at a scenario where greenhouse gas emissions are relatively high over the next 100 years, potentially we could be seeing a summer like that every other year. It's become an average summer. Hmm. And by about the 2060s, it would become a cold summer. Hmm. And to give you an indication that maybe we don't fully understand everything, then July this year was also exceptionally warm. So we thought that maybe the summer of 2003 was something like a 1-in-250-year summer, even with the global warming that we've seen to date. And yet we've now had that kind of summer twice in 3 years.
Right.
So maybe there are some things that we still don't fully understand there either.
Right. Is it possible to draw some... some kind of wisdom from that kind of finding, in the sense that, from a scientific standpoint, our understanding might kind of lag behind sometimes what is actually happening to our system and due to the rate of change.
Well, that's inevitably the case. Things happen in the climate system. Like the observation of the thermohaline circulation, things happen and we observe them, like the ocean acidification, and then we go away and we think we can see if we can try and understand it. So we can predict things, and we can predict some things quite well, but there'll always be surprises around the corner where the climate system springs something on us that we weren't expecting.
Hmm. There has to be a kind of basic difficulty in predicting something that's completely new from our kind of current understanding.
That's right.
Although there are...
I could take the Donald Rumsfeld defense. There are things that we know we don't know, and yet there are also some things we don't know that we don't know.
Yeah, okay. Right, okay. All right, well, thanks very much for your time. I understand it's a slightly awkward time to conduct an interview like this because we're waiting on the new IPCC report.
Exactly.
So you're not able to say
exactly
what's in it at the moment. So
that's right. I have read the draft.
So maybe it might be a good time to catch up again in the new year or something, with either yourself or one of your colleagues.
Yep, that'll be fine.
That was David Griggs, who is the director of the Hadley Centre, the Met Office's Centre for Climate Prediction and Research, and is also involved with the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. You're listening to the 2 Degrees Show, which takes its name, as you heard during that interview, from the target that the UK and EU have adopted as a maximum rise in average global temperatures, compared with pre-industrial times, that we should aim to keep below if we are to have a chance of avoiding some of the worst effects of climate change. To get an idea of the kind of action we need to take to meet this target, I spoke to Dr. Alice Bowes. She's a co-author of the Tyndall Centre report, Living Within a Carbon Budget, which was commissioned by the Cooperative Bank and Friends of the Earth and published in July this year. Worryingly, the Tyndall report includes the following statement. It is important to recognise that according to current scientific understanding, to have a very high probability of not exceeding 2 degrees C would require a complete cessation of carbon emissions from today.
Can you outline the brief you were given by Friends of the Earth and the Cooperative Bank when they commissioned this report?
Yeah. They basically asked us to come up with some scenarios that looked at a very low carbon future, and that was one that fitted within the 450 parts per million carbon dioxide concentration. And this is a level that is lower than the government's current thinking in terms of the current government aims for 2 degrees C, which was originally thought to be related to 550 parts per million, which is where they got their 60% reduction target from. But the latest science suggests that 2 degrees C is going to be closer to 450 and actually probably much lower. So we were asked to look at this 450 level and to see what that might mean for the energy system in the UK, so for transport, for electricity and for heat.
Without going into the detail today, I mean, the good news seems to be that you have demonstrated that kind of level of CO2 concentration is achievable with a set of policies which you've kind of outlined.
Yeah, I mean, we do think that this is achievable. I mean, it's certainly challenging. It's challenging from a government point of view because there will be policies that need to be brought in that are considered to be more restrictive, and depending on how that is, you know, delivered to the public, you know, those are sort of difficult issues for government to get over. So, for example, at the moment, the car industry doesn't have very strict regulations on fuel consumption per mile, for example, although there are sort of guidelines. If these regulations that are already around are ratcheted up and made much more severe, then obviously that will have an impact on those industries and on the individuals, the fact that people will then be buying much more efficient cars. And hopefully individuals will find that a positive thing because they will be spending less on petrol. But that would be the case that you wouldn't be able to buy a car, for example, that does 11 miles to the gallon, which you can still buy at the moment brand new. So some of these very large four-wheel drive cars. But what we are saying is that, yes, this is technically feasible, that it's politically feasible. But it's going to require a lot of action from government and from individuals and from businesses. Everybody needs to play their role in order to bring this about.
The report was commissioned to kind of back up the Big Ask campaign to see if what the Friends of the Earth are asking for is achievable. So that's, as you say, that it is achievable. But on the other hand, the detail of your report is saying that they might not be asking for enough.
Well, it depends how you get from where you are now until your target in the future. So, for example, if we continue to release very high emissions now and we don't do anything until 2049, then going down to a 60 or an 80% target on that date is not going to help us achieve our climate change target. Hmm. And so one of the things that the NGOs, Friends of the Earth, are looking at is asking for a reduction, a year-by-year reduction in carbon emissions. Within this piece of work, what we had a scenario that suggested that we didn't feel, to the best of our knowledge, that emissions were actually going to reduce prior to 2012, just based on the fact that aviation is growing very rapidly, and that shipping emissions are also growing. And we assume that all other sectors managed to stabilise their emissions, but actually, in fact, at the moment, we're burning more coal than gas, so emissions are actually on the rise at the moment. So we assumed this, whereas if, on the other hand, next year emissions start coming down, you know, we curb aviation growth and all the other sectors start to reduce their emissions, then you will look at there'll be a slightly different year-on-year cut until your target date. And basically the message is the longer you leave it, the more severe these cuts are going to have to be.
You presented the report at a side event at the Labour Party conference. What kind of response did you get from that?
Generally a positive response, but though I have to say that a lot of the people who come along are people who are interested in climate change. What we want to do now is to take these results to policymakers who are not necessarily, have been engaged in the past in the climate change issue, because it's a subject matter that's going to have to cover all departments. If we are actually going to tackle climate change successfully, then every policy has to have it underlying with some sort of climate change thinking behind it. And so what we need to do is address the Treasury, address the DTI, the Department for Transport, and to make sure that they're listening to the messages that we've put out in this report as well. So that's what we'd like to do in the future, and hopefully we're going to get an opportunity to do that.
One thing about the UK is that, Margaret Beckett used to put up as an excuse, carbon emissions might be rising in this country, but, if our emissions as a total of global emissions are quite tiny, so it doesn't really matter. What we need is a global agreement. But you're actually quite coming out quite strongly in the report that it actually does make a big difference what the UK does, and actually where we lead, others could rapidly follow, if you like.
Yeah, I think it's really important that we recognise that everybody has a role to play in this, but those in particular, those nations that are already emitting large amounts of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases per person. And in Europe, we're just second to the United States in the amount that we're emitting. So we're very high emitters, which means that if the high emitters don't start to take a lead role and do something about climate change, then we can't expect the rest of the world to follow, because why should they? We've had the economic benefit of using fossil fuels for years and years. And it would be a very difficult argument to then turn around to India and China and say, actually, you can't develop and change because, we've used up all the emission budget, basically. So I think the UK has to play a role. And because we have shown some leadership on this issue, I think it's a really important thing that the UK continues to be at the forefront of this and help to lead the way for, particularly perhaps for those nations that can't make those sorts of adjustments. I think there are a lot of things in the UK that we can do now that don't require, they don't require new technology. They just require us to make small behavioural change, to use the sort of technology that we have today. So, for example, a car that does 60 miles to the gallon rather than one that does 10 miles to the gallon. And to just look at it across all areas and play our part. And all those small percentages of emissions across the world are going to add up in the end. So we really need to do something.
Can I ask you briefly about George Monbiot's new book? I don't know if anybody at the Hadley Centre has had a chance to look at that. The Tyndall Centre.
We haven't had a chance to have a look at it. I mean, we've been in contact with George Monbiot in the past, and we've sort of fed into various parts of the book. He's come to us for this sort of information and that kind of thing.
Yeah. So you wouldn't be able to comment on how his... I mean, he's asking for... calling for a cut of 90% by 2030 in CO2.
Yeah, I haven't looked at this in detail. My understanding that he's looking at a level of carbon dioxide concentration, so that's a global carbon dioxide concentration, that's significantly lower than the concentration we were addressing in the report. And the issue is basically that there are... the likelihood of not exceeding this 2-degree threshold, which is the level that people call, above that is dangerous climate change, then we need to cut emissions by as much as possible, really. And I think that what George Monbiot has looked at in his book is cutting them at these very, very stringent levels, whereby we have more of a guarantee that we won't exceed the 2 degrees C, whereas our report looked at a level that was a little bit higher that gives us a good chance of not exceeding 2 degrees C, but not, it doesn't take us out of the woods at all. I mean, really, we need to be making even larger cuts.
Okay. I mean, it might be good to perhaps sometime later to have a look at some of the more detailed aspects of what you're suggesting and where some big cuts might be made. I don't know
okay.
if you'd... But just to give people an idea of the scale of the... and magnitude and urgency of what's going on, I guess.
The urgency thing is an interesting one, I think, because I think a lot of people think out to sort of 2050 and think, oh, well, that's a long time away, I hopefully won't be around, or I don't know, or maybe, it just won't be my problem by then kind of thing.
Mm.
And I just think that, it really matters what we do in the next 5 or 10 years. I think people are starting to recognise that. But I think the more we talk about that, then I think the easier it'll be in the future to manage these cuts that we need to make.
Yeah. So finally, what was the key message for government that comes out of this, do you think?
That they need to act as soon as possible to start actually reducing emissions and stop sort of tinkering around the edges. They need to make some more radical policy decisions to actually really start to tackle some of the high emitting sectors, such as the car transport sector, the household sector, and to look at the growth in the aviation sector.
Right, and how much time do you think they've got to really get to grips with this thing? Presumably, the quicker we put policies into place, the more chance we have of getting out of this.
Yeah, absolutely. Thing. I think that, I mean, it obviously takes a few years to get policies through the system, but according to our analysis, if governments act within the next 6 years and put some of these policies in place by then we might start to see some significant reductions by sort of 2010 to 2012, and that's what we need to do.
That was Dr. Alice Bowes of the Tyndall Centre, who co-authored their recent report, Living Within a Carbon Budget. As the report makes clear, we need to move rapidly to living low-carbon lifestyles if we are to avoid some of the worst effects of climate change. So next week, we'll be speaking to South London resident Donoher McCarthy and finding out how he manages to live on 1/16th of the national average carbon budget. Thanks for listening, and if you'd like to hear the show again, the programme is archived at coinnet, that's coinet.org.uk/climateradio.